I know that I am a sinner like the people I'm working with. I hope that I am manifesting the grace and to the love that I hope to be shown myself, and that I know that I don't have to do this on my own.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
This is Premier Christian Radio, and you are listening to The Profile. It's our weekly long-form interview with a Christian who has something interesting to share. I'm Tony Wilson, and I write for the partner magazine of this show, Premier Christianity. The monthly magazine has a host of feature articles and interviews just like this one. If you take a look at our website, premierchristianity.com, you're likely to find a subscription offer, and you can also read through our daily feed of news and comment. It's a great privilege for me to be talking with Dr. Gwen Adshead today. Having gained a Bachelor of Medicine at the University of London, Dr. Adshead went on to a Master's in Medical Law and Ethics before specialising in clinical psychiatry. Moving into the professional realm of forensic psychotherapy and working in prisons and secure hospitals, Dr. Adshead has become a global expert in criminal violence, working both with the perpetrators and victims. She won the Psychiatric Book of the Year Award from the BMA in 2013 and is also known for more popular works such as The Devil You Know, published in 2021. More recently, Dr. Adshead delivered the prestigious BBC Reith Lectures in 2024 based on the theme of understanding violence, discussing if it's normal, just an expression of evil, and exploring whether we can change people away from an inclination to violent crime. Dr. Adshead expresses her faith in the Anglican tradition and is a lay member of the Third Order of Franciscans. Dr. Adshead, welcome to The Profile.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Here on The Profile, we like to start with understanding the formative period of a guest's life. And so, at the risk of role reversal, perhaps I could invite you onto the psychiatrist's couch and ask you to tell us something about your childhood.
Certainly. And I have been a patient in therapy many times, so I'm used to thinking about this. Although, of course, every time I think about it, I probably think about it in a slightly different way, especially as the years go past. So I'm the eldest of three children, and both my parents were university academics. They were both historians, although my mother was a classicist and my father was a modern historian. And I think both my parents were practicing Christians, although my father had always been drawn to Roman Catholicism and in fact converted when I was 10. So debates and discussions about religion and faith were kind of live when I was growing up. And then later on, when my sister also converted to Catholicism, it gave me a lot of time and room to think about my faith. But I think it would be fair to say that I was raised in an Anglican tradition. So I was raised very much as going to church on Sundays, and I would describe myself as having a kind of ordinary culturally Christian background from that point of view. I also went to two different schools that had an Anglican tradition with hymns and readings and prayers as part of the school day and overtly as part of the school ethos. But and I continued to be a churchgoer after I was confirmed and I left school. But I think it would be fair to say that my faith was kind of perhaps shallow for a long time. Not heartless, I think, but not perhaps as deep as it might have been. And then I went through some difficult times within my own personal life that really made me think much more about who I was in relation to God and what I really thought about faith. And I also did some training in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which had quite an impact on me. and exposure to that contemplative tradition, which is, I guess, so that's kind of taken me to a place where I've, I think, had a deeper approach to faith, felt a greater personal connection with a divine presence, I think.
You used a really interesting phrase when you sent over your mini bio to me. You said that now you live in him, referring to God. I wonder if you could explain that in a bit more detail.
Well, I guess I'm thinking there about that wonderful expression of Paul's about being in Christ. And I think that when I say that I'm living in him, it is as much as aspiration as anything else. But I think that the wish to be living in the presence of Christ at all times, where Christ is the ground of our being and gives me roots to stand, I think that connection to Jesus as a living person, but also as the incarnation of the divine, together with the Holy Spirit, gives me a place to stand and root myself, I think, in a way which was not the case when I was younger.
And that deeply Trinitarian understanding of God is very deep and profound, isn't it? That God is himself a relationship of love, Father, Son and Holy Spirit. And we're invited to join in with that. It's something that I think you mature into as a Christian to appreciate that in its fullness. It's something that you develop over a lifetime of contemplative prayer, perhaps. I'm interested to find out how it is that you began to feel a calling towards medicine, psychiatry, psychotherapy, how that played in with the faith aspect of your life as you were growing up.
Yes, well, I did feel called to do medicine from an early age, although I will also say that I was greatly supported in this by my parents, and especially my mother. Her father had been a doctor. And that idea of a tradition of medical grandparents, at least, I think was quite strong. So, but I think also both my parents had health difficulties when I was growing up. And I think that did unconsciously influence my interest in becoming a doctor. And I think also my father had quite a strong interest in psychological therapy and psychiatry. And that also influenced me. I read books of his on these bookshelves in the house about psychological therapy and about the mind. So I was kind of that also made me curious. But then when I was at school, I was interested in Freud and was kind of drawn to psychological ideas about the mind. And so when I started in medicine, I wondered if I might go into psychiatry. But I thought, you know, it wasn't terribly sensible to decide at the beginning of medical school training. So, and in fact, as I went along, I was briefly interested in orthopedics, which is kind of yin to psychiatry's yang. If you like, it's very focused on the present moment and how do we fix things. And having once fixed things, we don't think too much about what's going on in that person's mind. But when I actually did my first psychiatric placement as a medical student, it just felt so familiar somehow. That sense of being interested in people's minds and motivations was so familiar. And comfortable in a way. I didn't have any kind of concerns about it. And then after I'd done my basic training as a doctor, I got shortlisted for pretty much every psychiatry job I applied for and not for any other jobs in medicine. So I felt that this was a message that I would be wise not to ignore. So I got a place at St. George's Hospital to train in psychiatry. But I was always interested in philosophy. And I began to be very interested in medical ethics when I was at medical school. And I was privileged to listen to Professor Sir Ian Kennedy's Reith lectures about the role of medicine and the role of doctors, particularly in ethical dilemmas. And I was very struck by those lectures. They had a big influence on me. So when I had an opportunity later on to do a master's degree in medical law and ethics with Ian Kennedy as a law teacher, I took it. But what that meant is that I then began to get very interested in how law and psychiatry talk to each other, particularly in the courtroom. And that was what took me to forensic psychiatry, because forensic psychiatry is clearly working with people in courtrooms of various kinds, most commonly where people's mental health problems have contributed to their committing criminal offences, or at least that's a question a criminal court wants to explore. And so my early work in forensic psychiatry was just that, translating psychiatric concepts into legal ideas in criminal courts. But I found the philosophy of it, how could mental illness alter your responsibility? How does it alter who you are and the choices you make? That was really what gripped me. And that's really what took me to forensic psychiatry, was the philosophy and the law. And I often say that I came for the ethics and I stayed for the stories. Because actually when I got into forensic psychiatry and started talking to people who'd done horrible things, I realized that they're, you know, literally, but for the grace of God, go I. That I, with a few different turns in the road, I myself could have done something equally terrible. And actually, you know, in my own small way, I might do things that were terrible, perhaps not as physically out there as some of the people I work with, but within my own realm of moral action, I also could make decisions that were cruel and heartless.
And I think this is a really interesting point that you raise, that when we think of good and evil, we often think of a line and we put ourselves very often on the good side of it because we feel that we haven't done things that are too awful. And we put other people on the evil side of it, particularly if they have done, committed a crime or something of that kind. And yet the reality is just far more complicated than that. And I have a quote here from Alexander Solzhenitsyn that I think is really quite important in this respect. And it might be a starting point, I think, for where you work from. And he said, the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts. This line shifts inside us. It oscillates with the years. And even within hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained.
Absolutely. That is absolutely the place where to start. And that Solzhenitsyn quote is a favourite of mine and also a favourite of a charity called the Forgiveness Project, which I've been a privilege to be part of on occasions. Because I think that what Solzhenitsyn is articulating is something really important about the fluidity of human hearts and minds and how people can change and how very good people can let themselves do terrible things. And terrible people, or people who've done terrible things, can also be capable of great goodness. And actually, this idea of categorizing people into either good or bad makes absolutely no sense, that we are living dynamic creatures living in an organic and social world. And I think that it is true that we are drawn to goodness. I do think that we have a very strong intuition about goodness and the absence of goodness. What C.S. Lewis would have talked about as the natural law. And I think that's absolutely right. And what's interesting about that, I think it's a shame Jack Lewis didn't live to read work by Franz de Waal about moral reasoning in animals like us, primates like us, evidence of that kind of moral awareness. Because I think that's where it comes from. And that there's something about a richness of goodness that we can recognize. And we also recognize its absence. And we yearn for goodness, I think. But sometimes that capacity for goodness fails us. And there's something about about the absence, something about cruelty that also begins to appeal. And often as we delude ourselves into thinking that perhaps by doing this thing, horrible thing, we're going to be doing something good or something that's justifiable anyway.
It's interesting, this actually plays into something that Augustine and others said, that actually evil in itself doesn't exist. It's simply the privation of a good. It's the whole left behind when the good has been withdrawn. And so, for example, if I steal something, that in itself is a privation of the good of working to earn the money to buy the thing that I'd stolen. So we've been deprived of a good. And does this cohere both around your professional experience and your experience as a Christian?
That's certainly been my experience. And I've certainly have not ever met somebody who was kind of born evil and just evil from the get-go. That, I think, makes no sense and isn't real. Although I think it is a very attractive trope for some reason. And people often ask me, aren't there people who are just born evil? And as if evil was a kind of colour, like going through a stick of rock, candy at the seaside, you know, that it was a kind of flavour of a person. But I think that in my experience, and this, of course, may be particularly based on working with people where mental illness has been part of their commission of acts of great cruelty, I think the absence of something good is really very clear often in their psychological lives. The absence of being able to think about other people is real. The absence of being able to think about themselves is real. The absence of trust, the absence of joy, the absence of many of the traditional, the classical virtues, for example, which I think are very interesting. The virtues are very interesting if you compare them with the seven deadly sins, if you like, because they have to be grown. They're a kind of way, they're a relational stance in the world. And I think it's absolutely true that many of the people that I work with are people who have either lost or never had that capacity for connecting with others and feeling that kind of connection wherein lies our capacity often for goodness.
And I think that really expresses so well this idea that when we're confronted with evil and we cry out against it, perhaps we're crying out for the good that should have been. We're crying out, we're drawn to the good. The good draws us in because God draws us in. Listening to the Wreath lectures that you did back in December, and I'd really commend anybody to go and listen, it's available on BBC Sounds, I really appreciated the way that you take a middle line. You sort of confound both the left and the right. And if I might crudely make a caricature of both of those, as the right wing sometimes saying things like, well, flogging's too good for them, lock them up and throw away the key. The left being more characterised by saying that this person's misunderstood, the hugger hoodie idea that David Cameron introduced and was roundly mocked for. Both of those get something wrong, and I wonder if you could talk to what it is that both of those ends get wrong.
Oh, well, I guess that one stance, the first stance, the very punitive stance, is incoherent in two ways. One, it's incoherent because it doesn't work. I mean, we have really decades of evidence that being punitive towards people really doesn't work and actually might make them worse because you're intensifying their shame and belittling them. And that is not a state of mind in which anybody can learn anything new. So that kind of punishment doesn't work. There are constraints, I think, that can teach people useful things, but that's not the same as the kind of punishment that you're talking about. But punishment is incoherent also because it fundamentally is embodying the wish to hurt that we have already condemned. So we are rightly appalled by the excitement of the wish to hurt somebody else, which is clearly present in many types of violence, particularly the kinds of extreme violence that appall and enrage us and are tragedies of a kind of cosmic order. When one thinks, for example, of the killing of the three little girls in Southport and the other people who were killed and injured, and people who witnessed that, and most appalling act of cruelty. But we then seek to punish the person who did that with exactly the same kind of cruel state of mind that we're criticizing him for. And that seems to me to be incoherent and unwise.
But doesn't justice have to kick in at some point? Do we not owe some kind of justice to those who have been wronged, to the people themselves, to their families? Isn't there some degree to which punishment is appropriate in certain cases?
I don't think so. I think revenge is an emotion that we can't afford. I think revenge, the wish to hurt because you've been hurt, is very natural and very human and deserves compassion and concern and attention. However, I think that like many human emotions, it is one that we can't afford to let rip. Just as we can't afford to let hatred let rip, or anger, or greed let rip. There are lots of human emotions that we teach each other to manage, and I think revenge is one of them. And in fact, the fact that we have national and international jurisdictions in which the state takes the part of the person who's been hurt, I think is a stand against vigilantism and vendettas. Because as Gandhi said, you know, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. So actually it's very important that courts stand up against the idea of revenge. So I completely understand vengefulness and the wish to hurt when you've been hurt. Nobody could possibly be in any way censorious of someone who's vengeful in that way. But I think the proper response is to be giving that person compassion and attention and time. And I am pretty convinced that if you give people time and attention and proper place to mourn and rage, then they will let go of that wish to hurt, and which is good for them in the long term, because holding on to a wish to hurt somebody else is unwise. I think it distorts you.
For sure, and of course, right at the heart of the Lord's Prayer, of course, is our desire to be forgiven as we forgive other people. So there,
well, and it's
that is.
Yeah, well, I don't want in any way to recast Christianity as good for your mental health, but I do think it is. It has something very psychologically healthy at its heart, which is a proper concern for both the individual and the social. But you asked me about the left issue, and the sort of left wing. Side of it is it risks it has a sort of two-part problem with it. One is that the wish to be compassionate can be a way of avoiding the reality of somebody's cruelty. I think we need to take the human capacity for cruelty very seriously indeed, and look at it in a way that is compassionate but also clear-eyed about the damage it does. And I've worked in a high-secure hospital for nearly 30 years, and I have seen how important it is to constrain people whose minds are full of cruelty and madness. And just compassion alone won't work. Just as shaming and bullying and belittling people doesn't work, so just being kind of nice to people doesn't work. And I also think that we are insufficiently respectful to the people who've done horrible things if we don't take their cruelty seriously. It's one of I see it as part of the job of the prison system, and certainly the bit of offender rehabilitation in which I work, to help offenders take their own cruelty seriously. That means taking them seriously as people. And if you just see them as unfortunate victims who couldn't help it, you are actually denying them an opportunity to stand up and be an agent who's a member of a community and take responsibility for what they've done. You're actually depriving them of something while saying that you're being kind to them. Again, this is an argument that Jack Lewis made many years ago. I obviously don't agree with him about support for capital punishment, but there is, I think he was right about the giving people respect for their agency and responsibility. And helping them take responsibility for what they've done, you need to be respectful of that they made those choices.
Hi, I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Every month, our team brings you deep, thoughtful journalism around the biggest topics affecting you as a Christian today. Our mission is to help you encounter God through the magazine. The latest issue features Switchfoot lead singer John Foreman, plus we're previewing the largest gathering of Christians ever. Find out more in the latest issue of Premier Christianity magazine.
I think that's a really interesting insight, isn't it? That the far left and the far right are two different ways of dehumanizing people. They take away our humanity in some respect or other. Two of the great weaknesses of those two approaches, I think. But I want to move on to think about the people that you work with. You work directly with people who have done some horrendous things, and you listen to their testimony. And it seems to me that the first thing you do with these people is to help them to recognize that things could have been otherwise, that a sequence of events that they had some agency over actually led to some horrific outcomes.
Yes, I think that's right. And the only thing I'd add to that is that process is not an event. But it can take quite a long time. I mean, my view is particularly skewed, I think, by the fact, again, that because I work so often with people who are mentally unwell when they commit their offences, it takes a long time for them perhaps to get into a state of mind where they can really kind of are able to look and think about what they've done. There's a wonderful Shakespeare quote where he has a murderer saying, "I am afraid to think what I have done." And many of the people I work with are men and women who are afraid to think. And we have to often help them to get to a place where they're not afraid to think. And that process itself can take a long time. And it's not just a matter of coming in and saying, "Now then, Mr. Jenkins, let's talk about what you did." You have to work up to it over time. So that people are ready to think about what they've done.
And I can see how this is a work of perhaps many years in some cases to work through these issues. And without obviously giving any details of individual cases, I wonder if you could take the arc of rehabilitation at its best, when the outcomes actually are what we would hope they would be. I wonder if you could paint us a broad picture of what that arc of rehabilitation looks like.
Well, an arc of rehabilitation starts with the it starts with the dust and rubble of the index offence that caused them to be in prison or to be in a psychiatric hospital. So the person who commits a terrible act of violence, let's say a homicide of a family member or a stranger, they're like the survivor of a disaster where they were the disaster. So there's the rubble of the offence and then all the processes that go with that. And that can be a very disturbing process, and just, you know, being arrested and being put in prison and then being, you know, going through police interviews and then the whole thing about having a trial and being in the public eye. And so really, in a way, the work of rehabilitation has to start when that's finished. You can't really do anything until the person has been found guilty and the judge has sentenced them to whatever it happens to be. And then the work can start. And because often people are pretty numb until that point. And also up to that point, their legal counsel, quite rightly, you know, will have been suggesting, you want to say that you probably will have said you want to plead not guilty, or that they may be in denial to start with. So often the arc of rehabilitation starts with helping people kind of just accept at what they've done, that they've been found guilty of what they've done, and this has actually happened. And that takes different people different amounts of time. Some people kind of get it straight away. Some people really can't bear it. The other thing that happens is that if they can't bear it, some people become very, very disturbed while in prison. I'm thinking of a man who got found guilty of joint enterprise murder, and having never been in trouble with the police before, and who went to prison to do a life sentence, not a very long one, but he'd never been in prison before, and he went absolutely mad, was very assaultative in prison, very, very disturbed, and came to our hospital for treatment. And there in our hospital, he became very suicidal. Something about the realization that everything that had happened, he became very suicidal. So the treatment then was about helping him. First, the treatment was about not letting him hurt other people. Then the treatment about not letting him hurt himself. And then, once he got through the other side of that, it was, well, now can we think about what happened, which was by this time was a few years past. Now let's think about what happened. And he was more able to take responsibility then, but also to see how he had misread the situation completely. So many people realize that what they thought was real or true back then at the time of the offense was neither real nor true, but they thought it was. It made sense to them at the time. And the realization that you've made a terrible mistake, that you could in fact delude yourself, is often something that takes people time. But once they're able to do that and they're able to acknowledge that they made a dreadful mistake, that they saw the world through a lens of madness and cruelty, both, and intoxication, obviously, too, big one. Then what you've got then is someone who says, well, I did this thing and I never want to do anything like that ever again. So how can I make sure that I don't do anything like this again? How can I desist from violence in future? And that process of desisting then usually takes people a bit of work to do some more self-reflection on how they came to delude themselves, how they came to let themselves do this thing. And often this means talking about losses and traumas. A lot of people who commit acts of violence have experienced childhood trauma, not everybody, but a lot of people. And a lot of people who commit acts of violence have had very serious losses in their lives, which have impacted on the way they see the world. So the arc is usually from a kind of denial, it wasn't me, to, well, it was me, but I was mentally ill at the time, to, well, my mental illness kind of made me do it, to, well, I did this thing, and now I need to understand how I came to do it. My mental illness was part of it, but it's only one part.
So you're painstakingly clearing the ground, you're moving that rubble, you're getting the person to a place where they can see more clearly, they can see the landscape around them, they're beginning to take decisions for their lives in the future. And I wonder if this is why the prison chaplaincies are so important. Are they helping people also to make sense from a faith perspective? We know that Alpha in prisons has been incredibly successful. I wonder if that whole faith dimension is important as people start to evaluate where they've got to in their lives and how they might like to move forward.
Well, yes, because I guess there are a couple of things there, aren't they? Is that many of the faith traditions start from a position that that to err is human. And so there's an acceptance of having made a mistake. But also many of the faith traditions talk about second chances and being invited to try again with help, and that help is offered. And chaplaincies are extraordinarily important in our prisons because they absolutely embody this idea that, yes, you've done a terrible thing, but that doesn't mean you're not a human being, because human beings make mistakes. Human beings are not perfect. And human beings do have a capacity to see again if they want to. If they ask to have their sight restored. And if you ask to have your sight restored, I want to see again. I want to see again in a new way. If you go to the chaplaincy saying, I want to look at things and see again in a different way, the chances are that somebody will say, yes, I'll help you with that, regardless of what faith tradition they happen to be in. Obviously, the Christian tradition has many such accounts, as does the Jewish. But I imagine that there are also those in Islam as well.
And you've been practicing now for long enough to have seen this over many cycles for many people, and no doubt you've seen some success stories with people being released from prison or a secure hospital, and that must be a real joy.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, after one of the many pleasures of the Wreath Lectures, one was that somebody got in touch with me who'd been in Broadmoor many, many years ago, and had treatment and rehabilitation, much as we've been discussing, and then was released. And eventually went out into the community and is married and is able to work and is able to explore his creativity, but also is able to contribute to his society, to his local society and community, in a way which means an enormous amount to him, because so many people who've done terrible things very understandably feel socially excluded, because they are. They feel like they've been excluded from the human. So to be able to reconnect to the human, to be reconnected to the social and be part of something again, actually helps them in their rehabilitation, which is why we do a lot of group work. Group work is a very important intervention with people in their rehabilitation, because other people who've been in the same position as you are will be very clear-eyed about any excuses you may be wanting to make. They can call things out in a way that the professionals perhaps can't. But also because by joining a group, you do rejoin society, you rejoin a community. And once you've joined a group, you're part of the human again, despite what you've done. And this is something that I learned from running therapy groups for people who'd killed when they were mentally unwell.
As we speak, it's been a few weeks since Netflix launched the 4-part series by Stephen Graham, Adolescence. It's now become a global phenomenon. It's been mandated by the Prime Minister for all secondary schools to show it. And so we have to talk about violent crime perpetrated by young people on young people. Barely a week goes by, it seems, without some news landing that there's been a horrendous knife attack, a murder, a young person's killed another. What is going wrong with society, in your opinion?
I know it doesn't seem like it, but actually the numbers haven't really changed in 50 years. And if anything, some aspects of youth violence are less than they were. The size of the young people's estate has been decreased quite significantly, and there are attempts to develop more secure schools and alternatives to criminal justice for young people who get in trouble with the law, because because we realize that often the path to criminal violence, not always, but generally starts with crime of any sort. And so if we can intervene with children and young people as soon as they get involved in crime, we may be able to divert them away from a path of serious violence. And it's also true to say that there are quite a lot of young people who are breaking the criminal law, but very few of them will be violent. And those people who, young people persistently violent, are the ones who really need help. So although we quite rightly should be worried and concerned about every time a young person kills another person, especially since they often kill another young person, I think we need to kind of keep our feet on the ground and just look at the data and remind ourselves that the majority of victims of violence are young men, and the majority of perpetrators of violence are young men. And so we need to start looking very closely at who the young men are who do this, because clearly not all young men are violent. So although we have quite, you know, although it seems like we've got a lot of young men being violent, in fact, they are a tiny minority of all the young men that there are. And the good news is that the vast majority of young men will never be violent to anybody. But so this should make us more interested rather than less in this very unusual group of young men. And I think that we have odd bits of data that are hard to put together because each person is slightly different. I think we do know that clearly access to weapons and substance misuse are two very, very important risk factors in the commission of violence. And what I tried to talk about in the lectures is an idea first developed by a colleague of mine called Peter Aylward, who kind of idea of a bicycle lock, where you've got a number of risk factors all lined up to make violence more possible. Now, some of those risk factors are so general that you can't do anything very much about them. Being young and male, not much you can do about that. But you could do something about access to weapons. You could do something about substance misuse. And I think we do know that exposure to lots of childhood adversity, particularly being exposed to physical abuse as a child and emotional abuse and neglect, these are experiences which look as though they could have quite a toxic effect on the developing brain. In the absence of any positive factors that might balance them out, exposure to child physical abuse, emotional abuse and neglect look as though they're risk factors that we might be wanting to intervene with sooner rather than later. But that means spending a lot of money and actually just restoring what we've lost. We used to have child guidance clinics. We used to have family therapists. We used to have many more people who were available to offer long-term psychological therapy for disturbed young people. And by and by, over the last 15 years, those services have all just vanished away. Now, that is something that we all have to take responsibility for, that we've allowed that to happen. Now, on our watch, we have allowed the services that did exist to just be destroyed, and we've not complained and we've not fussed about it, so that when we get a young man who's clearly very disturbed, he will be assessed many times, but no one will offer him treatment. Because we don't have all the people that we used to have who were trained in offering therapy to very violent and disturbed young men and women. And we need to be rebuilding that cohort of therapists, and we need to be funding them, and we need to stop assessing young people and offer them treatment, which may take at least 18 months, possibly longer, and will need to be in a place that is probably at least sometimes a secure place. So these are not going to be cheap interventions, but they may be infinitely less costly than the outcomes by when we don't help a young man who is clearly very disturbed.
I wonder if this also goes hand in hand with some research that's been published this week by the National Foundation for Educational Research in the UK. And it shows that for British young people, the social and emotional skills, we're at the bottom of the global league tables. And worse than that, actually, the inequality across those skills is the widest, so that the gap between those best able to manage their emotions and those least able is very, very wide indeed. So not only on average are we at the bottom, but also there's a great inequality across society. I wonder, what's your professional opinion on this situation? Could we be doing better for our young people to help them to manage their emotions, manage the social situations that they find themselves in?
Yes, I think what we need to understand is that children and young people in the first 20 years of their lives have to grow both an individual sense of mind and a relational sense of mind. It's not either or, you have to grow both. You have to be able to grow a reasonably secure sense of yourself and your own story of who you are and what matters to you and the kind of person you want to be. But you also have to grow a sense of a relational self and the importance of other people and the reality of other people's minds. And you have to understand, you have to learn how to manage what happens in the space between you and other people, especially people that you're close to, although not just those people, but it's just, you know, emotional conflicts particularly happen with people we're close to. We may not care so much about emotional conflicts with people that we don't like. But emotional conflicts with people that we are very close to cause a lot of distress. So, and the complexity of our emotional life as human beings is something that I think has not been taken seriously in terms of what education is for. We're very good at educating people in terms of facts and data and managing data and some kinds of creativity and some kinds of creative ideas and critical thinking. I mean, there are lots of good things about what we offer, but the psychological, the psychosocial side of things, I think, needs a lot more attention. And of course, as you say, there's a huge gap here because some schools and resources will pile a lot into this and really get it. And others, which have the schools that have far less resources, won't be able to offer very much. And the other problem is, of course, is a child is not a child on their own. They're a child of their family and their social and cultural background. And so when they come to school, they don't just bring themselves, they bring their family story with them. And that is often something that has an impact on how they relate to other people.
We've been talking about some fairly heavy and dark ideas. As we begin to draw things to a close, I want to turn our attention to building virtue, because as communities, as Christians, communities within churches, we should be focused on building virtue, helping each other to reject wrongdoing and embrace doing good things. And so I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about how we can make ourselves more resilient, how we can build communities that help us to become the best people we can be, to grow in holiness, to grow in sanctification. I wonder if you could perhaps give us a bit of direction in that respect.
Well, gosh, that's a big question, Tony, and I'm just one congregation member. But I guess that I would say that this is an area of learning and wisdom that there's a lot of traditional writings about. And of course it goes back to classical philosophy, because it starts, I think it must start with a willingness to look at yourself So there's the from the Socratic to injunction to know yourself, but also to the gospel suggestion that you have a look at the speck in your own eye before you judge somebody else. And I think that there's clearly something about thinking and reflecting upon your own strengths and weaknesses, which is helpful to being open to growing. Because what's fatal to the growth of the virtues is the certain belief that everything is fine, that you are fine. You are a kind person, you are a nice person, and that all is well, and it's those other people out there who are bad. And one of the curses of the age, of course, that has come with the internet and social media is the ability of people to criticize others for being bad while not looking at their own perspective at all. The fatal belief that by judging others as bad, you have somehow established yourself as good. And this is a fatal, fatal philosophical error on any number of levels. And of course, churches have played their part in this in the past and continue to do so. There are still some churches, I think, and church congregations who like to establish their sense of the good by criticizing others. And it's a very human thing to do. But I guess that where the church can help is by taking a process of self-reflection and contemplation of our own difficulties a bit more seriously. I would like to see more group activities in churches where we sit together, and rather than saying a brief confession together, we actually might sit, we might have circles where we sit silently once a week or semi-silently once a week with other people and say, there are some things I'm not proud of doing this week. I feel, when I think about this week, I think that I was unkind to my daughter-in-law, or I think I avoided calling my friend who's dying because it makes me uncomfortable to think that they're dying and I'm not. These kind of things, and I wondered if we made more spaces for people to be a bit more open and honest with each other about the ways that we get things wrong for ourselves and others. That it might be, we might be less keen to establish our bona fides, literally our bona fides, by being critical of other people. And that would be a start. And that would be a start because, as I said earlier on, I do think all the classical virtues are, what's interesting about them is that they are strengths that have to be grown and practiced. They are practices, patience. Patience is something that you have to practice doing. It's not something you can get off a shelf. It's something that you have to practice.
And I think that was expressed in the early church, in the church fathers, when they recognized that one way of growing the virtue is to identify the thing which isn't good in your life. For example, if you were prone to angry outbursts because of impatience, then you should lean into the opposing virtue of actually say, right, okay, I'm going to deliberately join the longest queue in the post office in order to practice patience. Yeah. And it is that sense of personal growth. It's the sense of belief that we can all change, that we've got the capacity to change, we've got the capacity to grow, and that we've got the capacity to become better than we are now. And I think that's exemplified in your work, certainly.
Well, I was just going to say that there's that wonderful quote from The Cloud of Unknowing, one of my favourite quotes, not what thou art nor what thou hast been sees God with his merciful eye, but what thou wouldst be. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's from the 13th century. And mm-hmm, said, what would you like to be? Mm-hmm, what kind of person would you like to be? That seems to me to be an important question that churches can be helping us ask ourselves week after week.
And it's similarly expressed in that phrase, every saint has a past and every sinner has a future. And that sense in which we're not the finished article. We're a work in progress. As we close, I wonder what you could say about how your faith helps you to cope with what must be a very demanding role in terms of hearing some of the things you have to listen to. How does your faith actually enable you to retain your hope and your joy in amongst a lot of suffering and misery?
Well, in two ways, I think. First, I have always had a very strong sense that this is what I was called to do, that this is what the Lord has asked me to do. So I had better go and do it. and I do that. So when I go to work, that's what I'm there to do, that this is what is mine to do. But also I know that I am a sinner like the people I'm working with, that I am manifesting the grace and to some, the love that I hope to be shown myself, and that I know that I don't have to do this on my own. I don't do any of this work on my own. Not only does God give me wonderful colleagues to work with, but that grace is there to support me. I have no doubt about it. And even if the work doesn't go well, I feel held in doing what I can on any given day.
Dr. Gwen Adshead, thank you so much for your time today.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.